All right. Good evening, everybody. This is the last installment of the Chabura for this Zman. And Mr. Shem, I look forward after the summit to reconvening. So today's topic, we promised to speak about prenuptial agreements. We spoke about Gittin. We spoke about the get process and some of the issues relating to Gittin. And today, we'll speak about the idea of the prenuptial agreement to prevent aguna situations. So one of the big problems that we know that our community faces is that sometimes you have a recalcitrant husband who refuses to give his wife a get. So a number of rabbanim over the past number of decades have come up with the idea, maybe you can have a prenuptial agreement that will require the husband to give a get, or require the husband to come in front of a bezdin if there's ever a dispute about a get, so that the matter can be properly handled by a bezdin and the husband won't just run away. Because Batei Din, especially outside of Eretz Yisrael, don't have, generally speaking, automatic jurisdiction over husbands to bring, or wives for that matter, to bring them into Bezdin regarding a get matter. So if they sign at least a prenuptial agreement that says that they agree that any such dispute will be handled by Bezdin, so maybe, you know, that provides a little bit more of a means to see to it that a get will be properly given when appropriate. Or you can even have monetary obligations that the husband will assume in order to ensure that he has an incentive to give a get, lest he would otherwise have to pay a large amount of money. The thing is that all of these agreements have to be structured in such a fashion that, number one, they'll be halakhically valid in terms of the underlying transaction that is indicated by the prenuptial agreement, whether it's an obligation to go to Bezdin, an obligation to pay money, that it would be valid, and also that it won't lead to a get meusa. It's not going to lead to a coerced get. If a husband's going to be penalized unless he gives a get, so we mentioned in the past that the get has to be given voluntarily by the husband. So that, I'll be pashtus, according to the simple understanding of the halacha, if a husband is faced with a penalty payment, and that's the reason he's giving a get, is to avoid the penalty, then that would be a coerced get, and it very likely would not be a valid get. So one idea of a prenuptial agreement is, let's use the already existing prenuptial agreement. The already existing prenuptial agreement is the ksuba, but if you wanted to enforce the ksuba, it doesn't say that the parties are obligated to come to Bezdin within the text of the ksuba. If there's a disagreement, what if the parties wanted to make it enforceable by from the standpoint of halakha and also the standpoint of secular law? By having a ksuba which says the parties have to come to Bezdin, and also spelling out the terms of the ksuba in English so that even a secular court will recognize and understand the ksuba, and they will enforce the ksuba. So part of what the ksuba says is that the husband takes upon himself that he's going to support the wife. So if he has an obligation of support, and that's going to be enforced by the secular court, so the husband might decide, rather than be required to support my husband according to what it says in the ksuba, that I would rather give a get in order to avoid this support requirements. So Moshe Feinstein, the ksuba that he wrote to his son-in-law, Moshe David Tendler Shlita, Moshe wrote that, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, that maybe the prenuptial agreement should just be there in addition to the Hebrew language ksuba, you have an English language translation. And but Yoel, he says, and this would be good, that we shouldn't have a situation where the husband just gives his wife a civil divorce and then he's me'agina, we're not giving a get. So he says, so it's better to have this this translation so that you'll have the ability to enforce the terms of the ksuba and the monetary support obligation that the wife has towards the ksuba. So that's a question, though. How effective is that really going? Is that really going to be? If the obligation of the husband stems from the ksuva itself, and it has to be circumscribed according to, you know, what the halacha would require the husband to pay, the husband's not always obligated to pay the mizonos obligation in the ksuva. The Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Ksuvos, Eben Ezra Siman Ayin Sif Yud Beis says, this is the Ramah. Ramah says, usually when there's a divorce, it's because the parties are not getting along. They have a fight with each other. They have irreconcilable differences. And they are not living together. If the reason is from him, so then Sark L'Shalim, then he has to pay the mizonos obligation of the ksuba. But if the reason that they're not getting along is because she just decided to take off in a huff, and she's a Moredis, and she decides that she's going to be the one cause the breakdown in the marriage, ain't that tzarek l'shalim. So then the husband is not obligated to pay the ksuba obligation. The ain't ish chayiv mizonas ishto like a shiimo, because the man's only obligated to pay for mizonas if his wife stays with him. If she runs away from him, and he's still in the city, he didn't run away himself. She just ran away from him. So then the simple understanding is that unless he drove her away because he was abusive, then he would be exempt from mizonas, and she wouldn't be entitled to it anymore. So that wouldn't be an incentive necessary for him to give a get if she's the one who left the marriage. And the Beis Shmuel in Sifkat and Lamedes, Lamedalet says that it's only in a case where the Machaber writes in Ba'amach Mastaina that she would have to have a taina as to why she's leaving the marital home and is still entitled to Mizonos, Haino Debirra Hadvarim, that she's the one who has to prove. When she's the one who leaves the marital home and she's the one who's the one who's filing for divorce, then she has to prove that the husband acted in such a terrible way or the circumstances were so intolerable for her that she would still be entitled to mizonos, but otherwise she's not entitled to mizonos. So my Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Willett, Shlita, points out that this solution of just relying upon the enforcement of the ksuba, even if you would translate it into English, is not necessarily a perfect ironclad solution. It happens that my own prenuptial agreement, when I got married, so it was important, I should set a good example, at least, and have a prenuptial agreement myself. I'm always telling other people to sign prenuptial agreements. That's my prenuptial agreement. I don't have the RCA prenuptial agreement. My Masada Kedushin was Rabbi Tema, so I have an English translation of the Ksuva. Okay, my wife is still happy, I hope. So the Rav Moshe Feinstein came up with another idea of what you can have as a form of a prenuptial agreement, because when you think about it, one of the major problems that we have here in the United States, as opposed to Eretz Yisrael, as we mentioned, is that we don't have automatic jurisdiction over the parties. We don't have the ability to force them to come in to the Beis Din. I think a famous Jewish thinker once said that 90% of success in life is showing up. So 90% of success when it comes to resolving aguna situations is getting the husband to show up. So the main thing is that you need to have an arbitration agreement that says that the parties can sign at the time that they get married, that says that in the event that there's ever a breakdown of the marriage and one party wants to get and the other party is not forthcoming, then the other party agrees they're going to go in front of the Beis Din and they'll do whatever the Beis Din says. So that's a short form agreement that Rav Moshe also has in his tshuvos, in Chelek Dalet Simen Kuf Zayin, in Eben Ezer. Somebody asked him, Yechiyot Tzchok Per asked him, Nachon Lahosif Shtara Tanayim, should we add in the Shtara Tanayim this lashon? Achavei Nisun Yavoli De Pirud Chas Tisholm. If after Nisun there's a separation in the marriage, Zabalo Yakim Nitzen Get Peturim Ishal Is Tisar For The Kabbal. The husband won't refuse to give a get. The wife won't refuse to accept the get if the Beis Din tells them. Kasher Kaki Sarei Beis Din Ploini, that they agree that they're going to submit to the jurisdiction of a particular Beis Din. It could be the CRC Beis Din, Beis Din of America, Makom Lahira, whatever the Beis Din is, and they'll give that Beis Din the authority to render a binding decision. And Rav Moshe says, this is a great idea because you also have the advantage that it will be not only halakhically binding as a shtar beruin, but it will be legally binding as an arbitration agreement. The courts will require the husband to actually show up and come in front of the Beis Din. So it used to be, when I first started working as the menial at the Beis Din of America, there were two separate documents that people used to sign. There was one document which was an arbitration agreement where they just agreed that if there's ever a disagreement about the giving of a get, they'll report to the Beis Din, they'll do whatever the Beis Din says. Then there was a secondary agreement, which was a monetary agreement that we'll talk about, where the husband took upon himself to pay a certain amount of money and monetary support as long as the husband and wife are still married to each other according to Jewish law. And that also provides a motivation that if the marriage is broken down, they're not living together anyway. So it would be better for him to see to it that they're no longer married according to Jewish law, so he doesn't have to pay the support obligation in perpetuity. But they were two separate documents. So I had a case in my early days in the Beis Din where the parties had only signed the arbitration agreement. They had only signed this document, which was similar to Rav Moshe's language, that they would go to the Beis Din if there was ever a dispute, but they didn't sign the monetary obligation. The husband ran away. He ran off to the Netherlands. He ran far, far away, that it was very hard to track him. And the wife thought that she's going to be in Aguna forever. So we pointed out to her, but you have to sign the arbitration agreement. So she contacted her lawyer, whoever was representing her in the Netherlands, where the husband was. And the lawyer showed up in the Netherlands with this document from New York, saying that if there's a dispute about the get, the husband's obligated to appear before the Besdin of America. And the judge told him, you have to honor this agreement, full faith and credit to any agreement that's recognized by another country. It was enforceable where it was executed. The husband said it was enforceable and required the husband to report to the Besdin of America. So the husband reported to us, and we told him it's really appropriate to give a get. And we felt, okay, so I'm subject to the jurisdiction of the Besdin, I have to give a get. So even though there was no other agreement other than basically the short form that Moshe had endorsed, that was able to lead to a get. So it really makes a big difference. I had a case recently where I was a Masada Kiddushin, and the husband told me that his Rosh Hashiva, he had a very prominent Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael, he didn't like all the different forms of prenuptial agreements that were being endorsed by the Besdin of America, Rabbinical Council of America, so forth, didn't like those agreements, had halakhic objections. So I was in a little bit of a quandary because the Rabbinical Council of America issued a resolution a number of years ago that if you're a member, I'm a member, then you shouldn't be officiating at marriages without a properly signed halakhic prenuptial agreement to avoid aguna situations. I even signed the letter back in, I think, 2012. There was a Rosh Yeshiva letter that was signed by many YU Rosh Yeshiva that said that everybody, when they get married, should really sign a proper a prenuptial agreement, encouraging, what does it say over here? It says, we're pained by challenges facing individuals in our community and denied a get. We therefore strongly urge all rabbis, educators, and community leaders to counsel and encourage engaged couples to sign such an agreement, to sign a valid prenuptial agreement, that will, a halakhic prenuptial agreement that will prevent aguna situations api halakha. And it was signed by major rabbanim, including Rav Herschel Schachter, Mordechai Willig, Rav Michael Rosenzweig, v'chule. So I signed that letter. So I felt, how can I officiate without the proper prenuptial agreement? I also believe in it. So I spoke to this this very chashuv, Rosh Yeshiva, and I discussed with him the tshuva of the Igros Moshe. So I said, look, the Moshe endorses the following formulation. So he said, fine. So put in that formulation. But Moshe writes that where should you put this formulation? So he says, knock on the hosif b'shtara tanoim. He says that you should add it into the shtara tanoim. So the Rosh Yeshiva asked me to just add it to the shtara tanoim so that it should be exactly as Moshe wrote it. So I did. Okay. So when I wrote up the tanoim for the wedding, I added this paragraph in the tanoim, the paragraph that says that im akve nisuin yavoli de piur chasa shalom as a balo ya akme leiting get peturim meisha l'tesari l'kablo, the husband will give a get, the wife will accept the get. So then somebody got up, you know, at the chasen stish to read the tanoim. He gets up at the test. So people like sitting there, what's going on? I never heard tanoim like this. So somebody called me up afterwards and they said, where'd you come up with this tanoim? This is like, you know, this is radical, you know, that you're already speaking about. I said, this was a chashuva Rosh Hashiva said I should do this. Okay. Nobody could complain. All right. So Rav Moshe says, however, there's one caveat. Yes, Rabbi Metenki. Yeah, that's an issue. That's an issue. So really what would make it better is if you had the chassid and kala side, at least the name as well. Okay. So Rav Moshe writes about Tov Shiyir as a chassid and kala v'yakim heite. It's important that you should have a good sense of the chassid and kala to make sure that it's not going to stare the simple altogether. That if you, by adding this tonight, they're going to immediately start thinking about getting divorced, so then it's not a good idea. So some, the poskim, even some of the poskim today, Moshe Sternberg has a recent shuva expressed the concern that it shouldn't be that the halakha prenuptial agreement creates an atmosphere where parties are already inclined to get divorced from day one, that they ready from the get-go or out of the starting gate, they're already thinking about getting divorced. But the reality is that maybe years ago, it wasn't so much in the air. It was a much rarer occurrence, so people didn't necessarily, you know, even know about such things. But nowadays, I think people are much more familiar, number one, with the fact that sometimes marriages, you know, do end in divorce. And number two, the fact that there's an aguna situation that needs to be resolved. So the mere fact that parties enter into this agreement especially if everybody is doing it, it doesn't mean that they're specifically geared towards getting divorced. It means they're setting a good example for everybody else, the same way that everybody signs a ksuba, despite the fact that the major reason for the ksuba is also to protect the wife in the event of a divorce. So therefore, for all these reasons, it's considered to be, I think, by most, many contemporary poskim, not such a concern that it's going to cause this type of machlokas. If anything, if you have a man who's sort of refusing to sign the prenuptial agreements, then you have to be suspicious. Why is he so reluctant to sign the prenuptial agreement? And maybe it's a little bit of a red flag if it happens up front. So why couldn't you just combine the first two ideas? Have this arbitration clause and put in the ksuba. That's what they did in the conservative movement. That was called the Lieberman clause. In the conservative movement, they had a ksuba called the Lieberman clause. I think Rabbi Shaul Lieberman. So he had endorsed putting in, and Ada Yom Hazeh, they do this. They have a clause in their ksuba, which says that we agree in the event that there's ever a breakdown of the marriage, we'll go to the conservative bezdin. So a lot of the Orthodox Rabbanim didn't like that proposal for a few reasons. Number one, whatever you add to the ksuba, ksuba is a very sacrosanct document. There are certain tanaim, certain lashonas that have been added over the years, but it's very limited in terms of what language you put into the ksuba itself. Better to be a separate standalone document. Number two, if it went to the conservative movement, we're worried that they're going to impose kenosos penalties that could perhaps lead to an invalid get. Number three, let's say the problem with the Lieberman clause is that it didn't say go to the Beis Din of America. It didn't say go to an Orthodox Beis Din. It said go to a conservative Beis Din. A lot of their gittin are not kosher because they're not done properly. They're not supervised properly or given properly. We discussed some of the problems in the past. So it was subjected to for all those reasons. So better that it be a standalone document. But what about the monetary obligation? So we said that a second component of prenuptial agreement is let the husband undertake a monetary obligation. So the problem is, it can't be a penalty. The Shulchan Aruch and Eben Ezer is the source. Hey, Hilchos Gittin, Siman Kuf Lamed Dalet Sif Dalet talks about what if a husband took upon a knas, a penalty that he would have to pay in the event that he doesn't divorce his wife. So the Rama says that's not considered to be it's not considered to be an onus because he's taking it upon himself, and he can make a decision whether he wants to give the get or whether he wants to pay this penalty he took upon himself. Nobody is imposing it upon him. But he writes, V'yesh machmirim afilu b'kai gavna. But he quotes a Rashba who says, no, that would also be considered to be a coerced get, even if the husband took it upon himself. He says, V'tov lochosh l'chatfilim. He says, l'chatfilim, you should be worried about it. But if the divorce already took place based on a self-imposed penalty, I get kosher. It would be a kosher get. Because, quotes a Ritva, because originally the husband wasn't coerced. He took upon himself as a demonstration of good faith that that he's writing the get on his own. So the Pisrei Tshuva in source Zion, we'll skip one. We'll go back to Bob in a second. The Pisrei Tshuva in source Zion quotes the Mishkanos Yaakov. Mishkanos Yaakov says that the Rama overstated his case. When the Rama said that there was some poskim who say that this is kosher, that's only when nobody was pressuring the husband into imposing this knas upon himself in the first place. And number two, when he just is doing it as a demonstration of good faith because he really wants to give a get. And then at the time that he gives the get, he's giving the get, not because he's worried about the penalty. He's giving the get because he really wanted to give the get. Just he took this knas upon himself as sort of an extra measure of good faith to demonstrate that he really, really means it, that he's going to give the get. So he took upon himself this penalty if he doesn't give the get. But if at the end he's only giving the get because of the penalty, so then it could be that everybody would hope that it's not a kosher get. So Yashiv Zatzal in his Kopitz Tshuvos and Chelik Beis Siman Kuf Samach Gimel, he quoted this Mishkanos Yaakov, and he said that he thinks that this is a real concern, that this is the proper interpretation, you know, of the Rama. That really, if it would be a case where the husband's only giving the get because of the penalty, everybody would hold that it's no good. And even in a case where he's giving it because he really wants to give the get, but he also just happened to accept the penalty in court, the stipulation, something upon himself or in a prenuptial agreement, something upon himself in addition. So then you have a machlokas in that case. And even in that case, the Rama says, Shetop lahachmir, that it's better to be stringent and only b'dieved would it be a valid get. But if you look in the tshuva of Rav Yashiv, you see that a lot of his diun is, was the amount that the husband took upon himself in terms of the amount that he would pay, was that the shir demei kolkola, shabach ayav l'seis l'isha mitoras mizonos, Was it simply the normal amount that a husband would have to pay his wife for mizonos, or was it a higher amount? If it was a higher amount, so then it's a kanas problem. But if the husband is only paying the amount that would be a regular support obligation, then you don't have this entire kanas issue altogether. It doesn't get off the ground. So that's the Piskei Tshuva in source above. Because the Torah's Gittin from the Baal HaNesivos, Torah's Gittin says a couple of interesting things, but we'll get to what the last few lines, the part that I put in bold. It says, the Baal could do the following. He can make a kinyan. The husband forgives, he waives all of the obligations that the wife has towards him. What would the obligations be? He's obligated to pay her mizonos. In return for the mizonos, the support, she has to give him all of her earnings. Okay, ma'isa yadeh, or a certain amount of her earnings. So he waives all of that. He waives any amounts that he would be entitled to from her, any shidutim he would be entitled to from her. No matter what she does or what the situation is, he's going to be obligated to pay her. Afim lo yigarshenu, v'hu yishayu achivim shelo. So even if they're still married, she doesn't have to pay him her earnings, but he's still going to be obligated to pay his mizonos. So that's okay, because he could take upon himself that he waives anything that she's obligated to him, as long as he's not imposing a penalty on himself. And he's not. He's just taking upon himself that he's going to have to pay a normal average amount of support. So then that would be a good incentive, says the Torah's Gittin, for the husband to give her a gekim shemonas menuko dover, because he's not going to get anything from her. He waived it, but he's obligated to pay her all the mizonas. And that's not considered to be a coerced get. It's only a coerced get, because she told the knas forget. It's only a coerced get when he says, I'm going to give a knas if I don't give a get. If he's not saying, I'm going to give a knas if I don't give a get. When they get married, he says, I'm going to pay her a certain amount of support, whatever the cost of living is, even if she doesn't give me anything. He doesn't say, in order to motivate me to give a get. He just says, I'm going to be obligated to give this amount as long as we're still married according to Jewish law. And guess what? In order to get out of it, he has to figure out how to make them not still married according to Jewish law. And there's a sort of convenient way to do that by giving her a get. But he doesn't say, I'm giving this amount of support in order to motivate me to give her a get. I'm giving this amount of support because she's my wife. And she's not going to demand it when they're still living together under the same roof, because she doesn't need to demand it. But when things go bad, so then she's going to demand it. He's going to be obligated to pay it, and he's likely to give her a get in order to get out of it. So he says, therefore, such a solution is a good idea. So Rabbi Mordechai Willig came up with this idea. Why not have a prenuptial agreement, which is premised upon this idea of the Torah's Gittin? That's where the Beis Din of America, also known as the Rabbinical Council of America, not that the Beis Din of America is known as the Rabbinical Council of America, but the agreement is known as either the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement or the Rabbinical Council of America prenuptial agreement. And it's based on this premise that the husband takes upon himself an obligation at the time of marriage. That's what's stated in the prenuptial agreement, that he's going to support, you know, his wife according to the way of Jewish husbands, in accordance with a normal amount of support for food, clothing, and shelter, recreation that a person would normally have over the course of the year in their socioeconomic circles, and waive any rights that he has to her earnings. And it doesn't say that it's tied together with a get. Somebody called me a couple of weeks ago. They said that they heard that this prenuptial agreement is such a great idea that it motivates a husband to give a get, and it prevents aguna situations. But it doesn't say anything about the amount that the husband's obligated to pay being tied in together with a get. I said, you know, you bet your bottom dollar doesn't say that, because that could cause it to be invalid. You look at the lashon of the Nesivos. Nesivos says the reason that it's good is because she'ein haknas tali beget klal, that whatever this amount is, that the husband is obligating himself to pay, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the get. It's not tied in directly with the get. So Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, so he looked at this agreement and he was asked to opine as to whether he thought that this was a good agreement. That number one, it says, if there's ever a dispute regarding the get, then the wife has the right to summon the husband has the right to summon the wife, and they'll listen to the decision of the Beis Din. And number two, that the husband takes upon himself this obligation to pay this marital support amount. And what the agreement says, he doesn't pay it from day one. Rabbi Bleich has a version of the agreement where the husband pays it from day one, because he said that really makes it stronger in terms of from a halakhic transaction perspective. But it has the lashon of saying it's going to be obligated, the husband is obligating himself me'akshav right away. Why does he have to say he's obligating himself miachshav? Because in addition to there being a knas problem, you don't want to have a penalty payment. You also don't want to have an asmachta problem. According to halacha, whenever there's a conditional obligation that somebody undertakes, that's not going to be payable until something later on kicks in. So then that may not be enforceable as a matter of Jewish law, because maybe the person doesn't expect the condition to ever happen and there isn't a sufficient gemiras das intent when he enters into that obligation. That's called a smachta. So a smachta lo kanya, smachta in a deraisa, for deraisa cases, is not going to, a smachta is not good. So so what do you do with respect to the smachta problem? So here you have two different approaches. If you look in source Yud, Mechaber says that in order to avoid an asmachta problem, you just undertake the obligation mei achshav, that it should be undertaken right away, even though it's going to set in when a certain condition occurs. Nonetheless, the person is undertaking the obligation immediately right now. It's not like the obligation will only be undertaken later on. No, the person says mei achshav, I'm undertaking this obligation, says the husband, that if we should ever cease to live together, we should ever cease to have a domestic residence together, so then I will pay you an amount of support at the rate of $150 a day. Where do we come up with $150 a day? We did research in terms of what is a normal amount of a cost of living for a person in our general communities. It comes out to around $54,000 a year. This has nothing to do with child support or the amount that you have to pay for children. It's the amount that you have to pay for the person's own upkeep. It comes out to around $54,000 a year. People ask, why don't you raise it? Because maybe, you know, from inflation, things get higher. So somebody, we had a financial expert to do extensive research in like all of the major from communities throughout the entire country, just about 3 years ago or so, 3 or 4 years ago. And it turned out that the amount was still accurate. It was still in this ballpark. So it says, me'akshav. So according to the Mechaber, that avoids the asmachta problem. But then the Ramah, in Sif Yudal and Simon Reish Zayin and Choshe Mishpat says, V'yesh omen the me'akshav l'chud lo me'honi l'salik asmachta. Some opinions say the me'akshav doesn't work by itself, but the bein gamken shikna we met him based on Choshe or me'akshav. You have to have both things. You have to have the lashon me'akshav, and also that it's done in front of a bezin choshev, like, you know, the CRC, right? You know, the people come to the Chicago Rabbinical Council and they sign the prenuptial agreement. Hopefully it's a bezin choshev, then everything is fine and good. But people don't always show up to our offices, the offices of the bezin of America, to sign a prenuptial agreement. So the Rama says in Sif Tezvav, he says that the im at siva litto b'shtar shekarev men bezin choshev, if the husband directs in the shtar that it will say that the kinyan was made in front of a chashiv abezdin, an important abezdin, avagav delokan umi honey. Even though it wasn't actually done with a kinyan in front of a bezdin chashiv, it was just done in a lawyer's office or something, that would also be good enough, or in the rabbi study, the hodas badin kamei edim dami, because we have a separate principle that if a person makes an admission, it's considered to be binding as a monetary matter. So a person makes an admission that they made a kinyan in front of a bezdin chashiv, even if they weren't in front of a bezdin chashiv, it still counts as if they did it in front of a bezdin chashiv. So you put together these ingredients. So the bezdin agreement says a me'akshav, it will be right away. And I acknowledge that I have now me'akshav affected the above obligation by means of a kinyan in an esteemed chashiv bezdin as prescribed by Jewish law. So therefore you get out of the asmachta problem by doing all of those things. Okay, so assume you've gotten out of the asmachta problem. So what about, even if I... let's say that I got out of the asmachta problem, but it still can't be a knas, it still can't be a penalty. Then it would be an effective obligation, but the effective obligation could cause the get to be a coerced get. So Vashu White said that under these circumstances, Shabbat, second line, fourth word before the end of the line, Shabbat, Yakabal, Atzim, the finance, the Sishta, Vesikum, Sabir, Mikubal. The husband takes upon himself to support his wife in an amount which is reasonable calibrated to the cost of living. As long as they're married according to Jewish law, they're not living together, no problem. You have two good things about this idea. What's the first one? Number one, it's not a knas, it's not a penalty, but it's a reasonable amount of mizonis. And number two, that it's not tied in directly to the get. It doesn't say anywhere in the document that this is for the purpose of incentivizing the husband to give the get. It just says he's taking upon his obligation for as long as they're married together, and for May Akshav right now, and the amount becomes payable when the support doesn't happen automatically, when they're not living under the same roof, as long as they're not living together domestically, as long as their domestic residence ceases, so that it makes sense that we should quantify this amount of money, that he'll pay this amount, they'll pay this amount of money. We had a case where the man separated from the wife, and he thought that they were going to reconcile, but she didn't ask for a get. 6 months passed, and she never asked for a get, and they're talking to each other on the phone, talking about maybe getting back together again. And she said, after 6 months, you know what? I want to get him. By the way, you owe me 6 months of support because you signed the prenuptial agreement. It didn't say it's only for refusal to give a get. It said that's what makes it effective, right? You said that as long as that may actually, you're obligating yourself whenever domestic residents are together ceases. So the Bezdin Paskin, the Bezdin of America Paskin, that he was obligated to pay 6 months of support. And he said, but I'm willing to give the get right away. You know, that's not the idea of the agreement. So then it was appealed. Bezdin of America has an appeal option. So they appeal to the Abbez, and at that time it was Rabbi Schwartz. Rabbi Schwartz delegated it to the Sagan Abbez, and to Rabbi Willig to hear the appeal. And Rabbi Willig overturned the decision of the lower court Bezdin upon the appeal. As he said, there's also a halacha in Siman Ayin in Shulchan Aruch that says explicitly that if the wife does not claim the mizonos that she might be entitled to, so then she's considered to have waived whatever mizonah she didn't claim. So as long as she wasn't claiming the amounts that were in the prenuptial agreement, she waived everything up until that point in time. So the wife got very upset about the reversal of the lower court decision, so she appealed to the Court of Appeals in the state of Maryland, where apparently, I guess, the parties lived, and the Court of Appeals looked over the decision of the Bezdin. And they said, this looks eminently reasonable to me. We uphold the appeal of the Bezdin. Okay. But one of the svaros, one of the arguments of, it's called Lang versus Levy, if you want to look it up. So one of the arguments of the judge in this case of Lang versus Levy was that the whole purpose of the prenuptial agreement is to bring about the get so that the husband shouldn't withhold the get. And therefore, since the husband was never withholding the get, he was never refusing to furnish the get, so he shouldn't be penalized for the 6 months that they were separated. How did the judge come to that conclusion? It didn't say anywhere in the agreement that the purpose was the giving of the get, because on the instruction sheet had said that it's really good to enter into this prenuptial agreement in order to prevent the guna problems. So Rabbi Zalman and Nechemya Goldberg subsequently met with Rabbi Willig, and they were going over the prenuptial agreement in order to reaffirm Rabbi Zalman and Nechemya Goldberg Zatzal's support of the prenuptial agreement. Rabbi Zalman and Nechemya Goldberg said, you know, you shouldn't say anything about the monetary obligation being tied into the get, not in the text of the agreement, and not on the instruction sheet either. So Rabbi Willig then said we should take it out of the instruction sheet. So after that decision, it was taken off of the instruction sheet. But that decision was able to rely upon the fact that at least it was mentioned in the instruction sheet. I think it's Yadua. It's Yadua to the world that this helps to prevent aguna situations. And Rabbi Weiss writes in his tshuva, that's not so bad. As long as the actual formula, even in the instruction sheet, wouldn't be so bad according to what he wrote. As long as the actual formulation of the agreement is that it doesn't, it's not tied into the get itself. So he felt that that would be perfectly okay. And it's not a knas because it's tied into a monetary obligation. So one other possible source for why this works is that this is not a newfangled idea. If you look in the halakhic legal forms of the Nachla Shiva, anyone here a lawyer? Lawyers know that we have something known as Bloomberg forms. Bloomberg forms is a fellow named Bloomberg. I don't know, not the one who was mayor of New York. But Bloomberg is like a legal service. You know, maybe it's started with a particular person named Bloomberg that comes up with the official legal forms for everything called the Bloomberg form. So Nachla Shiva was like our halakhic Bloomberg. And he came up with forms. They had Teriska form, Ksuba form, you know, you name it, form. One of his forms is what he calls Tanayim Achronim. Tanayim that are signed at the time when people get married, in addition to the Ksuba. And this is a long form, Tanayim form, that came from Takana Shum, from spire worms and manes, ready for many hundreds of years. They had such a form that says, if you look in source Yud Aleph, I saw it, Mazel Tov Yasmech B'Yalet, starts off with nice Lashanas, and then it gets to the nitty gritty. M'chas Hashem Shiaseh, Mar Ploni has the zugaso. If the husband should be mean to his wife, and she can't take it anymore, they have to go to Bezdin. He'll have to give her 10 zuhubim a day for every single month. 10 zuhubim a month in order to take care of her support, in order to take care of her monetary needs. And as long as they're on the outs with each other, he has to pay this amount. And Be'erid, a few lines words later, then they should go to a bezdin of their choosing. Mamish, exactly this prenuptial agreement. They choose a bezdin, they're going to go to that bezdin that will decide, toka basis, shibuas, akabakashasa mimeno, within 2 weeks after she has to go to the bezdin. And until that point in time, he has to pay this asara zuhubim. They listen to whatever the bezdin says. So Rabbi Willock said, it's not always going to turn out that they'll get back together again when they go to the bezdin. Obviously, sometimes it's not going to work out, and there'll be a get, but the Nachla Shiva seems to hold that this is a perfectly fine agreement, that he has to pay this amount of money. It might end up being an incentive for him to give her again, yet we see that this was considered a perfectly legitimate agreement. But the last few lines of the Nachla Shiva says, after the bezdin works things out, she'll go back to his house. They'll work out that he'll be nicer to her. They'll get along. So Rabbi Willock said, yeah, but it's not always going to get along. So Rabbi Usher Weiss looked at that raya of Rabbi Willock. They said, it's a good raya up until the last line. The Nachla Shiva assumes they're not getting divorced. So you can't bring this as a proof that this is all going to work to motivate him to give a get. This was clearly not for the purpose of motivating him to give a get, because the idea was they should reconcile in the end. Rabbi Willock says, no. But you can't assume that they're always going to reconcile, so this could be okay. So some say, what? There's a parenthesis says that in the event that they can't decide on a bezin, there is no bezin in their city, then they'll do a zablo. Each person chooses one die, and the two dayanim will choose a third die, and they'll do it that way. So at one point in time, Rabbi Yashiv was approached to see whether he would give his endorsement to the prenuptial agreement. He wasn't so excited about giving his endorsement. In general, in Eretz Yisrael, they're less excited for sort of a separate policy reason. It's a very good article that was written by Amichai Razina, a very, very smart person. He wrote an article in a journal called Mishpatim, and he explained that one of the reasons you'll find a certain amount of resistance in Eretz Yisrael, even among the Rabbanim Harashim, the prenuptial agreements, because it serves a totally different purpose when they do it in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbanut HaRashi has automatic jurisdiction upon the party, so they don't need a prenuptial agreement to get the parties to come into the Besdin. The Besdin automatically has jurisdiction anyway over the parties, and they also have jurisdiction to impose all kinds of, you know, monetary judgments against the parties and so forth. So therefore, there isn't the same urgency, and the feeling in Eretz Yisrael is if they're going to sign a prenuptial agreement, maybe that's because they're trying to avoid the Rabbanut, and they don't trust the Rabbanut to do an effective enough job in terms of adjudicating the cases of pi halacha. So therefore, that's why there might be more of a sensitivity within Eretz Yisrael. In my own sefer, when I wrote my sefer Kanavianos, I had a couple of simanim where I spoke about different aspects of prenuptial agreements. So David Lauschlito, when he wrote in his Haskama, Divrei Bracha, at the beginning of the sefer, said, I noticed that you spoke about prenuptial agreements. Shino, I'm not so crazy about prenuptial agreements, you know, unless they make it clear that any monetary obligation of the husband is not, you know, for the person tied in to the fact that he's withholding a get. So since I got, you know, his Haskama before I published my sefer, so I added a footnote, you know, when I spoke about prenuptial agreements, and you should know that the prenuptial agreement used by the Bezin of America and the Chicago Rabbinical Council does not tie in the monetary payments to the non-giving of the get. So it should be okay, even according to Rabbi Lev. So Rabbi Yashiv expressed the four concerns that he had with respect to prenuptial agreement. One concern was that it might be an asmachta. So, and the second concern was the husband may not understand what he's signing. The third concern was that it might be a knas, a penalty payment. And the fourth concern was that it encourages women to go to the secular courts. So Rabbi Willock said he thought that all of these were surmountable. The asmachta is surmountable if you had the lashon me'akshav and the husband said it does it in front of a bezdin chashuv. Especially if he shows up at the Bezdin Chashuv, if the Chassan and Gal show up at the Bezdin Chashuv before the wedding to sign it. It's even better, noch besser. Number two, in terms of lack of understanding, so source Yud Beis quotes from the Shulchan Aruch, Hoshem Mishpat, Simon Samach Aleph, Sif Yud Gimel, that says that Misha Tana, Ksuva Sisha, Sheyama Aretz, a person who signed the Ksuva, and they had all kinds of clauses in the Ksuva, and he said, I'm a Nam Aretz, I don't understand what it says in the Ksuva. I didn't understand. I'm under the chuppah. This guy is reading the ksuva. I don't know what he's talking about. Ain't showman law. So he said, we don't pay attention to the husband, because if you sign something, this is when, you know, he either signed it or he was made a kinyan, and so that the able to see his makapa kinyan. So it's understood that that he understood what he was signing. So the Ramah says, everything that's written in a contract, certainly if a person signs it, you can say the ksuva, the husband may not always sign, but the prenuptial agreement he's going to sign, So it's assumed that when you sign something, you understand what it is that you're signing. Some say maybe he didn't understand that he has a right, that the asmach is not binding unless it's in front of a bezin chashuv. He didn't understand that he was waiving his right to a bezin chashuv by doing a hodas bal din. Okay, so if that's a taina, then it should be spelled out. By the way, you're waiving your right to a bezin chashuv by saying that you're doing that. It's as if you were signing in front of a bezin chashuv. As far as the knas concern is concerned, so we explain it's not a knas if it's tied in as a support obligation. But what if the $150 ends up being too much? Well, so that's where Sternbach tied in. Sternbach said in Eretz Yisrael it's going to be too much. The answer is so in Eretz Yisrael you make it less than $150. I think the investment in America has a form of $75, something a little bit less. But what if it turns out that even according to whatever the lowest standard is, it's still too much money. So then you have to give the best in the ability to alter, to modify the amount when it hears the case, if it determines that the amount that's written in the shtar really is more than whatever is the standard living of these particular parties. Olimo veno yeredisimo, women's entitled to the larger amount of whatever she's used to or whatever the husband comes from. But if it's but the amount is low for both of them, so maybe it really should be a lower amount. So we're trying to figure out how to do that without necessarily changing the streamlined language of the prenup that has a set amount that I think makes it a little bit more shovel and chol nefesh and easier for everybody to sign. So I came up with the idea. They now have this language in the prenuptial agreement that says that the husband is taking upon himself this obligation of Jewish law, according to the requirements of Jewish law governing Jewish husbands, that I am going to pay in lieu of my Jewish obligation of support this amount of $150 a day. But what did it say? It said, according to the requirements of Jewish law. So I said, so we can make it clear that language, according to Jewish law, means that the Beis Din has the ability to adjust. But we don't want to adjust the amount in every single separate agreement, because then the whole thing will fall apart. You won't have a streamlined agreement anymore. So we used to have the language as here and above cited. So I added two words. I said two words that the Beis Din will understand. And from a legal perspective, it clearly would have this import so that the Beis Din would have that power. But it doesn't take away from the streamlined nature of the agreement. I added the two words as here and above cited and circumscribed. As here and above cited and circumscribed. Whatever language comes beforehand, it can circumscribe this amount. It could be that, according to Jewish law, maybe the amount needs to be adjusted a little bit. Okay, so that was my, addition. The Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg addresses really the last point. The last point was, we're worried that the women will go to our coast. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, Fakir, the whole value, or one of the major values in his eyes, when he was endorsing this prenuptial agreement, and this is a tshuva by Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg that you'll find in the Yeshurun Journal, in Kracha, volume Yud Aleph, was that he said, Achein, second line, that one of the reasons, one of the reasons why women go to the court, she might figure she'll get a better deal in the secular court than in the Beis Din, and they don't trust the Beis Din to give them as good a deal. That's why I came up with a suggestion that she can ask the husband when they enter into the prenuptial agreement that everything should be divided 50-50 according to community property rules or according to equitable distribution rules that are generally practiced in the society around them. And you put that in the prenuptial agreement. And Adarabi said anybody can agree to any kind of monetary condition, in terms of how assets are going to be distributed. And this will be an incentive for the wives as well as the husbands to agree that they're going to adjudicate all matters in front of the Beis Din. And in fact, that is one of the clauses in the prenuptial agreement. It's an optional clause because the Maisa, not everyone will sign it, but you don't have a clause that says, and the parties have the right to go to secular court with respect to anything other than the get, that you're not going to say, but you encourage them to sign this paragraph that says the parties agree the best and it's authorized to decide all monetary disputes, including division of property and maintenance, that may arise between them and to utilize principles of equitable distribution in accordance with customary practice, as the Beth Din deems appropriate according to principles of Jewish law, equity, and local customs. So the Beth Din can look at what's the practice of monetary dealing between the parties to figure out if equitable distribution is appropriate in their particular case. But this way, everybody, including the women, can feel much more comfortable submitting to the Beth Din for the adjudication of all matters and not go to our coast. And if anything, the prenuptial agreement is a great tool and resource to prevent the parties from going to prenups to civil court, and instead to indicate in the prenuptial agreement that they will adjudicate all of their disputes in front of the Beis Din. And I have to tell you, I wouldn't say it's a booming business. I mean, it's not look like we're looking for this business. So we want all couples to be happy and to have lasting marriages and not to get divorced altogether. But more and more couples that do get divorced do come to the Beis Din, we find, to adjudicate all aspects of their divorce. In addition to, you know, the issue of the get, and halakhically speaking, that certainly makes it stronger. Again, if you're coming from the vantage point of Eretz Yisrael, so there you figure you already start with the jurisdiction, and any agreement might just come to take away the jurisdiction. But here you're starting with the fact we have a separation between religion and state, and the parties don't automatically come into the Beis Din. So the prenuptial agreement helps to create that sense of, you know, this arbitration agreement that the parties are agreeing to come to the Beis Din. So that gives us, you know, more jurisdiction. And it bolsters the kavod of the Beis Din in the halakhic process at the conclusion of the divorce. So we have come to the conclusion of this zman in terms of our chaburis. It's a real pleasure to be back together. And in Mr. Shem, I look forward to seeing you again after the summer. Everybody have a wonderful summer.
Have there been any challenges to this that successful?
There's going to be a three-week series about the dry bach. The rest of the things.